So let me just, before we start the sheet work part, I wanted to just sort of put out a question/request. We have a sicha slot scheduled tomorrow between 4:45 and 5:45, and I wanted to ask people if there are particular things that you want either us as a group to talk about, or that you want to hear me talk about, and then we have a discussion about, either approach me in person sometime today, or email me before like 6:30 tonight, so that I can give some thought to that. And obviously, I'm not going to be able to do everything people suggest, but it's also useful for us to know going forward if there are some things that other people might be happy to talk about, etc. So just sort of consider that as an opportunity to ask for stuff. That would be helpful. Okay, so where are we in this series? We spent the last two sessions, the first one talking about gratitude, and the second one talking about Rav Dessler's notion, finishing up with gratitude and talking about Rav Dessler's notion of Hanotein v'hanotel, and then coming to the conclusion of his that the notein is really the only kind of person who is capable of feeling and expressing gratitude. What I want to move to in this session is the question of Tzelem Elohim, being created in the image of God. And I want to say something about how we got from gratitude to Tzelem Elohim. Okay? So what gratitude to God, at least partially, implies, certainly the way we read the Rambam, the very first source we read from the guide, what gratitude to God implies is that the world didn't have to be, and it is, and that's a gift, right? We talked about that a lot. That's the kind of chesed of creation, olam chesed yibaneh. And it's almost like saying that the first building block of a Jewish theology and spirituality is gratitude for the world having been created. And once we establish gratitude for the world having been created, we obviously have not established that philosophically as an argument for creation. We've talked about, right, beginning from an experience, right? Once we talk about gratitude for the world having been created, we then move to human beings not having just been created, but having also been created, B'Tselem Elohim, right? And that becomes sort of the second piece of this sort of building a theology or spirituality, or at least as I understand it, for whatever it's worth. Now, we spent some time during the winter learning seminar on one aspect of Tzelem Elohim, and that is on the sort of recovery in the last 20 years of the idea that God is present in the human being, including the human body, and that the human body is considered by Chazal, by the sages, a kind of icon of the divine, or the divine presence, right? What I want to do today is think a little bit about what I think are the three most well-known rabbinic sources about Tzelem Elohim. Today, we're doing sources that I'm guessing almost everyone in this room has seen at least once, and we're going to try to kind of play with how we would build a theology of Tzelem Elohim out of them. And then next time, we'll look at some directions that a theology of Tzelem Elohim might go. You may recall that in the beginning of the sicha I gave on Shabbat in the fall, I talked about living with the gap between, on the one hand, what our theology says, and on the other hand, the reality of human life as it unfolds in the world. And just to sort of reiterate that quickly, because I think that that's extremely important, right? And it's, to my mind, in a certain way, where Jewish theology gets interesting, right? Is to say that on the one hand, right, we affirm that because each and every human being is created B'Tselem Elohim, consequently, every human being is infinitely valuable. And on the other hand, we, if we're awake to the reality that confronts us every day, we see that human beings are degraded, suffer in countless ways. Everything from political oppression and degradation to illness that racks and destroys our bodies and our minds, to loneliness that threatens to make us feel totally worthless, right? I mean, different people have different... Thankfully, not everyone has all of these experiences, and certainly not simultaneously. But if we're willing to be awake to the world, that is, to simply walk down the street with our eyes open, or to read the newspaper every day, right? Then we're aware that all of these things are not things that are episodic in the world, but are pervasive and threaten to make our talk about the value of human beings seem sort of absurd. Right? And that's a tension that I want to suggest. If you want to have a theology that is both true to its sources and committed to facing reality and the world as we know it rather than hiding from it, you have to live inside that tension. Right? And as I suggested to you then, and I'll say it again now, I think one way to understand the covenant between God and Israel is to think of it as an attempt to join God in the work of making that claim of Tzelem Elohim not just some kind of pipe dream, but actually some reality we can inhabit. By the way, in some ways, more poignantly than when I said it, you know, in the Sicha on Shabbat, was something, Alex, you said, Alex Braver, during, right, one of the process groups at the home, right? About how do we talk about the value of every person and then, you know, go for a walk in an Alzheimer's unit and feel like dignity is mocked, basically. That wasn't your language, but, right? Where dignity is arguably stripped away from people. Now, I'll just sort of add a caveat that one student who I taught this to at Yeshivat Hadar a few years ago, this idea, said to me, I actually think you have a lot more work to do, right, in figuring out exactly what it means to say that illness robs people of dignity. Which I think is a really interesting thing to talk about. I'll just say what I mean by it. I hope it goes without saying that I don't mean to make some kind of blanket, silly, almost dumb statement that people who are ill have no dignity. What I mean is that illness of various kinds threatens to undermine aspects of ourselves that we think of as constitutive of our dignity. The ability to complete a sentence, the ability to communicate a thought to another. Right? I mean, with both in group, in sort of in co-ed ways, and with a lot of you in our time at the Jewish home, we've had versions of conversations that are actually in some way about this, right? Maintaining the dignity of someone who appears not to have aspects of what we think of constitutive, of, we think of as constitutive of our dignity. And we can talk about this more, obviously. Sheena, maybe you'll write a book about this. Right, Jewish conceptions of health and dignity. No, I think that that's obviously a really important and difficult question. But I'm sort of suggesting that being alive to the gap between Judaism's conception of what a human being is and the world's reality of how human beings are treated is kind of totally fundamental to taking Judaism and the world both seriously and to kind of stepping into what it means to be an inheritor of God's covenant with the Jewish people. Okay. Any sort of questions or comments about just that framing or those thoughts that I just put out there? Anything? Anybody have anything they feel that is urgent to say or add? Okay. So, in that case, so, for those of you who were here for a summer, I beg your forbearance that we're going to start with a source that I have usually begun the summer sessions of Yeshivat Hadar with, but if there's any source in Chazal that bears Chazara, it might be this one. We're going to start by looking at one of the most well-known sources in rabbinic literature, the Mishnah and Sanhedrin, about Adam HaRishon, and build from there. As I said at the beginning, for those who walked in along the way, today's goal is really to focus on, right, what I think are the three most well-known Ma'amarei Chazal about human dignity, and then next week sort of maybe move in some interesting different ways with them. And in order to Lehavi Geula La'olam, which to bring redemption to the world, which Chazal say is brought to the world by citing one's influences and sources. Some of you may know that this Mishnah has been at the center of my teacher, Rabbi Yitz Greenberg's theology and teaching for the last 40 years at least. I'm going to read it a little more psychologically than his reading, but he is sort of in many ways the great prophet of this Mishnah. So reading the Mishnah in Sanhedrin, this is, just to be clear, an excerpt from the middle of the Mishnah. It contains neither the beginning nor the end of the Mishnah, which is actually about what we tell potential witnesses in a capital case. That in itself would be interesting to talk about, but we're looking at this. And what I want us to do is not allow ourselves to be sucked into, oh yeah, all the sentences of this Mishnah I already know, and they're totally cliche, and they are, you know, used on every fundraising poster for everything Jews are ever trying to raise money for. Right? You know, the synagogue plumbing is not working. One who saves a single life is as if he saved an entire life. Right? I want to avoid that temptation and actually make sure that we are willing to sort of see what's going on in this Mishnah. Okay. Lefichach nivra Adam yechidi, right, therefore was Adam created alone, or singly. Lilamdecha, or really lilamdach in Mishneh Hebrew, to teach you. Shekola ma'abed nefesh achat, we're going to talk about this at great length. Shekola ma'abed nefesh achat, ma'aleh alav akatuv ki'ilu ibeid olam maleh, v'chola mekayem nefesh achat, ma'aleh alav akatuv ki'ilu kiyem olam maleh. Right, this is to teach you that one who destroys a soul, a single soul. Here, by the time of Chazal, nefesh has come to mean soul, but it might also mean person. One who destroys a person. Ma'ale alav akatuv, scripture considers it as if he destroyed an entire world, and anyone who saves or preserves a single soul or life, scripture considers it as if he saved a whole world, or maybe even the whole world. So, this is, you would say, I guess, right? The first claim here is the infinite or absolute worth of every human being, right? What we learn from Adam HaRishon having been created as one is that a single person is, in some fundamental sense, equivalent to the whole world. So the first meaning of a human being is infinite worth. Now, many of you learned this Mishnah. Those of you who went to Jewish day schools, many of you who went to Jewish day schools probably learned this Mishnah in a slightly different nuscha, right? A slightly different version, which I have on the bottom. Why the second quotation mark disappeared? It's between me and the people at the Melel software company. I have no idea. It says nuscha acheret mi Yisrael, right? Which is that there are many versions of this Mishnah, many printed versions of this Mishnah that say, "Belamdecha shekol ha'ma'abed nefesh achat miYisrael ki'ilu ibeid olam malei, v'chol ha'mekayem nefesh achat miYisrael ki'ilu kiyem olam malei." Now, I just want to sort of put out there, right, that this is probably the best case of the clearest case of something that the more you learn Jewish texts, the more it becomes sort of obvious to you, but it's sort of like fascinating, is that Jews, right, often fought, you would say often fight, about some of the most basic questions of theology, identity, and ethics by pachkiing with texts and girsaot, right? You think that there's some kind of, you know, oh, it's just a different version, but nothing less than everything, in a certain way, is at stake in how you choose to read this Mishnah. Right? Because either this Mishnah begins with a statement that Adam HaRishon's creation is the source of human dignity, or you read it to mean this Mishnah, Adam HaRishon's creation, is the source of Jewish dignity. Right? Kolam Abed Nefesh Achat versus Kolam Abed Nefesh Achat in Israel has a huge gap between it. Right? One is a fundamentally universalist teaching about what it means to be a human being, and another is a deeply particularist teaching about what it means to be a Jew. Now, there are even sources, right? You know, these are not the sources that normatively I want to emphasize, right? But there are quite a few sources in Jewish tradition that actually try to suggest that it's Jews who are created with Tzelem Elohim and not other people, right? And I don't think we should lie about those sources, although I think we should actually, the opposite, be upfront about why we are choosing to privilege and prioritize the other sources. Two things about the origins of this Mishnah. First of all, Ephraim Urbach, one of the most important scholars of Chazal in the last generation, showed through an examination of basically every manuscript of this Mishnah he could find that the original language of this Mishnah is Kolam Abed Nefesh Achat, and that the Mi Yisrael is a sort of, you know, someone who read it and couldn't deal with it in some way. But I actually think that this is a case where you don't need manuscript research, right? Because the Mishnah makes no sense if it's Mi Yisrael, right? The Mishnah is about Adam HaRishon. If the Mishnah said, right, Lefichach Avraham Nifchar Yechidi, right, therefore was Abraham chosen alone, then you could say this is a Mishnah about the dignity of every individual Jew, and Avraham is the paradigmatic Jew, etc., etc. But this is a Mishnah about Adam. This is a Mishnah about Adam. Which I think makes it clear that unless you kind of are so committed to the exclusion of Gentiles from dignity that you're willing to read it in a totally tortured way, right? The pshat is clearly that we're talking about human beings, right? I don't actually think there's another coherent reading of the logic of this Mishnah other than to say that it's about people. And you could take it one step further and say that Sefer Bereishit itself makes that choice, right? Many cultures, when they tell their story of origins, tell the story first of the story of their particular culture, right? Bereishit makes a conscious choice not to do that, right? And that is extremely important, right? Bereishit tells the story of the creation of the world, and neither the people of Israel nor the land of Israel appear in that story. They are not, as it were, in the eyes of Bereishit, as opposed to parts of Chazal and all of Kabbalah, they are not in themselves primordial categories. Right? There is the human first, and then eventually there is the Jew as God chooses to enter into covenant with Avraham. Right? And similarly, there is the earth and not Eretz Yisrael. And that's not a coincidence. You know, some people, I have to say, I find this extremely unpersuasive. Some people like to say, oh, Genesis 1 to 11 are really only there to set up for the stuff that matters, which is Genesis 1, which is Genesis 12 and onwards, right? Genesis 12 is the appearance of the covenant with Abraham. I think if you were to read the Chumash without that assumption, either because you're particularistic or because you're out to condemn Judaism for being too particularistic, right? It would be unlikely that if you read Bereishit, you would choose, as you were editing it, to say, before Genesis 1, preface. Right? And before Genesis 12, to say, okay, chapter 1, now we're ready to get going. I just think that's a very odd and idiosyncratic reading of Bereishit, and deeply agenda-driven. So, we have here a Mishnah that in its origin is about the infinite dignity of every human being, and we have to deal with the reality that at various moments in the history of Jewish thought, it has been read to mean in the history of Jewish dignity. Now, one sort of footnote, this is kind of a way of reading Chazal, learning how to think about manuscripts to go from theological to the merely somewhat obscure, right? There is a third version of this Mishnah in circulation that says, Kol ha-ma'beid nefesh achat mi-bnei ha-adam, from among human beings. I think that as you learn to have a sense of this, it seems pretty clear, right? And you'll tell me if this logic makes sense to you, that that third version of Ibnei HaAdam comes from a copier, a manuscript writer, who read the corrected version that said Mi Yisrael and chose to re-emphasize, no, we're not talking about Israel, we're talking about humans, right? That the language of Ibnei HaAdam, from among the children of Adam, is an attempt to refute the corrupted version of Yisrael, and that most likely the original version is simply Nefesh Achat Tzuru, with no elaboration. I can't prove that, right? But it seems to be sort of the logic of how you imagine some of these texts evolving. Okay, I just said a lot of different things. Any comments or thoughts about this before I go on? I'm sort of just listening to myself talk here. Yeah, Rachel. I don't know. I don't think so. You mean Echad versus Achat? No. It's actually probably little more than a scribal issue. And may even result from someone being confused about the fact that the plural of nefesh is nefashot, but it doesn't end with a hey, so they got confused about gender. I'm guessing that that's probably how it happened. So I think it's most likely extremely insignificant. Of course, as a child of a dikduk teacher, the nefesh that I just said that it was a function of dikduk and said it was extremely insignificant. And I have to go do an al-chet, but it's insignificant theologically, if not Hebraically. Yeah, Ross.
Are there later texts that read nefesh not relating to people, but to beings in general?
Beings in general? No. I mean, I know of one. In fact, I would say the opposite, if I understood your question correctly. It is commonplace, already in the medieval period and definitely in the modern period, that when people try to answer that question that we spoke about at length during the college week, right? When people try to answer the question, what is Tzelem Elohim, assuming that they're assuming that Tzelem Elohim is not the totality of the person the way we said, one of the ways they often formulate that question is what is it that a human being has that nothing else in creation has? Meaning that they understand the category of Tzelem Elohim as deeply tied up with human distinctiveness. In other words, it's a category of the creation of the human as opposed to the category of created being per se. Does that answer your question? Yeah, so, I mean, I know someone, you know, who's a kind of contemporary theologian in the renewal community who is trying to develop an argument that everything created is created by Tzelem Elohim. I think that that's, you know, in terms of the tradition, a completely implausible argument to make. I mean, I have some sympathy, although not so much, for why he wants to do it, but I don't think there's any source of that, and we could actually mount texts that basically say, Tzelem Elohim equals, right, that which God enacts in us that God enacts nowhere else. Anybody else? Yeah.
Just to defend the honor of a day school education, I'm pretty sure I learned all three Mishaot in day school.
Great. I'm not out to attack day schools. I'm just, you know, just out to attack day schools. Anybody? Yeah.
Even though I don't particularly like the reading that it's Mi'Yisrael, I think that your argument against why it can't be still, like, I think it's somewhat circular. I think it still assumes what it sets out to prove.
Tell me how.
Well, I wonder why it couldn't be that. I mean, I get the idea, well, like, it's Adam, not, you know, Abraham, which was my first thought, too. That if you're drawing back to Adam, then it has to be everybody. But even if it is drawing back to Adam, I don't see why the Mishnah couldn't read Yisrael from that and just say, like, but the only people we're talking about is Yisrael. And, like, we're just making that exception. And we're drawing back to Adam because that's creation. And we like the singularity of Adam because that, you know, metaphorically and allegorically works well for what we're trying to say about the singularity of our people. It's a really great parallel. Just like Adam was singular, so are we. Super special.
So I would say, you know, just for now, right, that given that the logic of the argument you're making is a little tortured, yeah, right, sort of the burden of proof would be on you, on your argument rather than mine, in the sense that I think the way that I'm reading this Mishnah plays out the logic of Adam better than the particularistic reading. Could you make such a reading? You could. You could invoke certain sources. I mean, I'm not totally sure about these sources, but one contemporary Israeli scholar, Alon Goshen Gottstein, suggested, right, that actually some sources in Chazal think that Tzelem Elohim is lost with the Chet of Adam HaRishon and restored only to Israel at Mount Sinai. I'm not sure about that. I really have to think about that much more carefully. I don't. you know, I'll say this, normatively, I would not want to go in that direction at all.
Right.
Whether or not there are sources that would imply that, I don't know yet. But, you know, there's enough sources that are rapidly particularistic on their face that I don't actually feel committed to reading torturedly to make the ones that aren't also be that way.
I agree with you. I just see, like, there's a way that you could read this where the logic of the analogy being perfect isn't as relevant to it just being parallel. But...
Well, I think you'll see in the next one that it actually is about descent and not just parallel.
Okay.
But fair enough.
Okay,
Shayna, and then we'll go on.
I have to say about the Nefesh Echad and Nefesh Echad, that it also might point to the universal element here, that it's not just singling out like the masculine or feminine Nefesh, but that it is pointing to like all souls, I guess.
And are you suggesting that as the pshat of what the Mishnah is doing, or as a kind of midrash that you're doing on the Mishnah?
I don't know.
Okay. By the way, those of you who know me by now know that I don't think that question is, for the purposes of doing theology, all that relevant. I'm just actually curious about your reading.
I mean, well, I think it must... I guess there's some element that it's
pshat
because it...
moves between. Well, right, so in order to really get at the question whether it was pshat, we would have to do some manuscript research, which I have not done in this Mishnah. But as a Midrash, it's actually quite beautiful. Okay, so now, just to sort of now try to follow the logic of this Mishnah, right? So imagine that you are really trying to take the ideas of this Mishnah seriously. And you say to yourself, okay, I'm going to try to live in such a way that I take seriously the notion that every human being I encounter, and for that matter, every human being I never encounter, is infinitely valuable. Right? And I ask myself, how would my life change if I took that seriously? How would the life of my community change? How would my life, the life of my country change? How would the life of the world change? And you hear this little voice in your head that says, maybe explicitly and maybe implicitly, okay, every human being is infinitely valuable, but I am a little more so. Very few people, I think, would formulate that as a thought, and if they would, very few people would verbalize it as a thought. But as a kind of way of going through the world, right, I think it's actually fairly common. And you might even argue that in certain contexts it might be unavoidable. We could have that discussion too. But I think that the logic of this Mishnah is now going to be, wait a second, I know what you're thinking, I know what you're going to do. Right? You're saying, okay, everybody's infinitely valuable, that's a nice idea, but after all, I'm me. I mean, I am the center of the world, right? Because when I experience the world, I'm usually at its center. Unless I spent my life meditating on self-transcendence and it actually worked, and I'm not thinking about myself all the time. But, I mean, I'm the center of the world. Because most of us, even if we're thinking about self-transcendence, are thinking about ourself trying to self-transcend. I'm the center of the world. No, I'm serious here. You know, I mean, okay. I'm just talking about myself. Yeah, no. Yeah, Ross, go ahead.
The last part of the Mishnah, or the section of the Mishnah that you're showing us, actually encourages the readers to say that, that I am the center of the world.
Hang on.
Okay.
Hang on. I'm gonna try to open that possibility, and then we can try to respond to it together. Okay? Okay, so now the Mishnah continues, and we're going to get to that role. Umipnei shlom habriyot. And Adam was created alone. This is sort of part two of the Mishnah. Adam was created alone in order to create peace among human beings. Shelo yomar Adam lechaviro, Abba gadol me'avicha. Okay? That a person should not say to his fellow, my father was greater than your father. Now, what I think, right, is here an attempt to say, is that every human being is, in some sense, equally infinitely valuable, as it were, or if equally infinitely valuable troubles those of you who are interested in math, we'll say absolutely valuable, and that this Mishnah prohibits an appeal to origins to do comparative worth. Meaning that if you take this line of the Mishnah seriously, this is a total rejection of the possibility of racism legitimated from a theological perspective. Because the claim is every human being on the face of the earth has exactly the same origin. In some more ultimate way, there is no such thing as race. Now, so imagine the version that says, yeah, you know, everyone's infinitely valuable, but now let's be totally crude and offensive for a second. I mean, let's face it, you know, people in the first world are worth more than people in the third world. People in the first world were starving to death. I mean, we would all be totally in crisis about that. But, you know, Africa is destroyed by us. Okay, so whatever, they're infinitely valuable. It's like a, you know, whatever. I hope no one in this room would ever say that out loud. But what, I hope no one would ever think that, let alone say it out loud, but there's a way in which culturally that might actually be something that happens in a lot of people's minds and experience. And this Mishnah, I think, is actually about, at least partially, combating that temptation, right? Now, then we could wrestle with, right, would that every Jewish source in the history of Judaism lived up to this Mishnah's rejection of the possibility of theologically sanctioned racism? Right? Would that that were the case. But that's what this is about. This is about a statement about the equal, the radical equality of every human being. By the way, here's a one-minute Hebrew lesson which will sort of maybe surprise you. The word Abba in Hebrew means my father. It does not mean father. In Aramaic, Abba means Av Sheli. That's why in modern Hebrew, it's only because modern Israelis, you know, I hope you're not offended by this, like, Dikduk and the history of Hebrew is not like a huge part of their kind of conscious Hebrew. The phrase, Abba Sheli, is like horrific Hebrew. It's standard Hebrew, but it's terrible Hebrew. Abba Sheli means Abba Sheli, Av Sheli Sheli, my father. And Abba Shelcha is actually not acceptable Hebrew at all. It simply makes no sense. There's no such thing as Abba Shelcha. There's Avicha. Now, of course, if you say that, you sound like a weirdo. But the word Abba means my father, and Ima means my mother. That's why the Mishnah can say Abba Gadol Me Avicha, meaning Avi Gadol Me Avicha. Okay.
It's interesting philosophically.
That what?
Parents, the parents of everyone, because it's like your Abba. That's my father and is your father.
You, are you talking about this mission or are you talking about weird Israelis? Okay, so this is called raising a lack of dikduk into a kind of ethos, which I like.
Also, by the way, equally infinite is totally legitimate, but not
I know, but it freaks people out, and so I've backed away from using it. What did you say? Yeah, okay. Great. Okay. Now, the Mishnah is going to be very careful and do something else here. It goes on to say, this is part 2b of the Mishnah, we'll say, V'shelo yehu minim omrim. What are minim?
Heretics.
That the heretics not say, harbe rishuyot v'shamayim. There are many powers in heaven. Now, I want to suggest something to you sort of very forcefully, which is, it's common, I think, when people read this mission, I think, oh, this is sort of like a brackets comment. Oh, Adam was created alone, so that you not say, oh, Adam was created by this God, but Jimmy was created by that God, right? And I actually think that there's something else going on here, which is an argument that says, and I understand that the gender issues here are real, although I'm not going to address them right now, that the argument here is, not only do we all have one father with a small f, namely Adam HaRishon, but we also have one father with a capital F, God, right? That the temptation, which sounds maybe obscure to people in our cultural context, to say, these are the children of light, and these are the children of darkness, these people are God's people, these people are the people of the devil, is systematically rejected here. Meaning, you can neither appeal to human origins, nor to metaphysics, to sanction your obsession with declaring human beings unequal. So the temptation here, the Mishnah, I think, is in two prongs, responding to two ways that people have often moved to declare themselves more valuable than others. Right? One is to say, look, you know, I'm descended from white people. or whatever offensive version of this you want to have. I mean, or, you know, if you want to not centralize this, you know, the Nation of Islam's version of, you know, black people come from God, white people come from some weird creature named Yakub, right? I mean, you find all kinds of crazy versions of this, right? And on the other hand, right, also not saying, oh, God created us and you guys are sort of refuse. Again, I think that second one is very hard in our cultural context to make sense of, because certain kind of Enlightenment universalism has already won the day in a certain way. And yet. So far we have, right, the infinite value of every human being, and then the equal infinite value of every human being, or the equally infinite value of every human being. Yeah. John. Wow, that's all time.
Deflect if this is, like, jumping ahead, or if it's irrelevant. Are you claiming that because every human being is equally valuable, and as such we can't stake our own value or the value of people we care about as inherently higher than anyone else, that says something about the nature of our obligation to other people being equal for all people?
I'm not saying anything about that yet.
Okay.
I'm not saying anything about that yet.
Okay.
I mean, I think it might be already implicit here, but so far we're sort of theorizing the human.
Sure.
Right? That's all we're doing so far. Yeah.
All right. I don't know if this is, like, way over-drashing this, but I'm thinking, like, going back to the whys, the Dalit, and then the use of Abba, and then the use of, and then it's specifically about God. If you could almost view it as all different aspects of God, right? So, like, the Echad, if you take, like, the, I don't know if it's Kabbalistic or what, understanding of the Shema, that Echad means that everything is God. So, like, Nefesh Echad would mean Nefesh, that part of God, and Abba really meaning my theology about Abba, my Father God, is greater than your theology about God, and then explicitly, I guess, the last one talking about God.
Yeah, that is, I mean, I'm not supposed to be out of hand, but that is wildly midrashic, meaning, right. First of all, the notion that everything is God, first of all, I have to say, I don't know what it means. Right. I mean, I know that makes me sort of a little untrendy, but I don't know what it means. But I don't think you'll find any source in Chazal that would ever say something like that. I think Chazal would call that kind of idolatry, or at least incoherence. I mean, in other words, you can still do an interesting drasha, but I mean, and really, the standard source that's invoked for that everything is God is less the Hashem Echad than the Pasuk Ein Od Milvado. Right? That's a kind of standard Hasidic. I don't know how early in Kabbalah that is. It's most dramatically manifest in Chabad. Right? Atahor Eita Ladat, you have been shown to know Ki Adonai Hu Elohim, that God is God. Ein Od Milvado, which means, of course, in the Pshat, there is no other God but God, which Chabad, especially attempts to read as Ein Od Milvado, there is nothing else but God. Okay. So, yeah, that one I'm willing to paskin on as, like, late post-Hasidic drush. Abby.
Can you just explain what you mean by infinite value? Because I'm not really... Every human being has infinite value. What do you mean by that? What is infinite? Is confusing.
It's a really interesting question, and I'm not sure that any sort of philosophical context can define infinite exactly in a non-mathematical, non-quantitative discourse. By infinite value here, there's a couple things I mean. One is that it is sort of stubbornly non-quantifiable, right? You can never say a sentence like, a human being is worth X. So, right, we're going to compute what it means. Now, of course, there are problems with this, because Chazal, in certain halachot, seem to do exactly that.
Yeah.
And actually, there's interesting research going on these days about how the Bible is much more committed to a view that much more consistently committed to a view that kvod adam, the dignity of a person, is never quantifiable. Chazal end up, I would say, internalizing some of the Roman preoccupation with precisely that, hierarchizing human value. here's a crude answer to this question. It's not an answer. It's an anecdote. So I had the very sad job around, I don't know exactly when it was, 1997 or 98, testifying at the trial. My roommate, when I lived in Jerusalem, was killed on one of the first 18 buses that blew up in Jerusalem. And so I was testifying at a trial that his parents were suing the Iranian government. And so one of the people they have there is an actuary. And he stands up there with a piece of paper, right? And he then computes, right, exactly what the punitive damage number should be for taking Matt's life. And on the one hand, you know, I have no opinion about, like, the what international law or American law should be on this question, but I remember wanting to get up in that courtroom and start screaming, right? This is a sacrilege. Like, I cannot sit here and watch this. Like, you're actually going to place a number on his life, right? So that's the first thing infinite means, I think. And the other thing I think it means is that, and this also raises, I think, important and difficult sort of practical questions of ruling a society. You can't ever make the cheshbon, the sort of calculation that said, okay, I'm going to sacrifice this life for some other value. I'll say it in one other way, okay? I taught this mission a couple years ago, and someone said to me, you know, and this was in a public lecture, so it was like, and it was said very forcefully, what's the work that this idea does, right? And what I suggested in response that I think is important here, and maybe it would be helpful for people to think about this, is that the notion of the infinite value of every human being cuts in two ways simultaneously, right? It both forces us, on the one hand, to not sort of sacrifice any individual for some imagined collective good, and at the same time, it forces us to expand our sense of who's in the collective. So it both radically particularizes and it radically universalizes simultaneously. Because it's, right? It's about never sacrificing an individual and realizing that you're talking about human beings and not just the people who are your friends. So that image makes sense. It pushes us inward and outward, as it were, in our circle of community. Does that make sense? Do you understand what I just said? Because I think that's actually like an important way to think about the potential theological and ethical work that Tzelem Elohim in general, and this Mishnah in particular, can do for us. Okay, yeah.
You say sacrificing people for an imagined good.
What about sacrificing people for a real good?
Yeah.
So give me an example of that.
I could come up with all sorts of fantastical examples, but if it's like very clear that one or a few people's lives could or should be sacrificed to save many people's lives, what would you say about that? It seems obvious to me that what course should be taken, but I don't know if you have more creative
right. So,
idea
so I want to not, you know, this is, you know, it was, I think it was Philip of Foot, right, who just passed away, who was great.
Trolleyology.
Exactly. You know, this notion of like, what do you do, you know, in all these imagined ethical cases with, you know, the train that's coming, you can divert it and kill one person or not divert it. You know you're going to kill that person. Those are really, like, serious ethical theory questions. I don't want to get into them here, both because I feel hopelessly overwhelmed by them in certain ways and because I feel like it'll take us far afield. You should know, actually, that in certain ways in the Shoah, one of these years here at Yeshivat Hadar, if I can sort of find the intestinal strength to do this, it strikes me that a really interesting thing to do would be to actually read many of the tshuvot that are written by poskim during World War II. This question comes up a lot in halacha, right? Like, oh, like, well, what happens when the Nazis say, give us one, or we'll kill all of you? Is it permissible to give them the one? Really, really sort of interesting versions of this. I happen to think the answers to that question are almost never easy, by the way.
I don't think anybody would say they are.
Well, in other words, I think for people who say that it's obvious, right, that the answer is you sacrifice one to save lives, not sure, right? I'm certainly sure that Jewish sources have not been sure. But your question is totally well taken. I mean, and there's a reason why I said imaginary, because I was actually trying to deal with the cases that are easy and yet totally common practice in various ways in our world. So I'm not answering your question now, but I'm happy to talk about it. Okay, so now if we push further, now comes the next sort of piece of logic, which is, okay, if everybody is equal, then doesn't equality run the danger of effacing or erasing all difference? And then comes, as a result, the Mishnah's attempt to deal with that. And it says, right, again, an extremely famous statement of the Mishnah, which I want to spend a minute on. Ulahagid gdulato. So this is number three, for the third reason that Adam was created alone. Ulahagid gdulato shalakadosh baruch hu, and to tell the greatness, proclaim the greatness of the Blessed Holy One. She'adam tovea kama matbeot bechotam echad v'chulan domin zel azeh. ומלך מלכי המלכים הקדוש ברוך הוא תבע כל אדם בחותמו של אדם הראשון ואין אחד מהן דומה לחברו. I'm going to stop there for now, right? This is to tell you the greatness of the Holy One, that a person makes 1,000 coins from one stamp and they are all identical. But God is not so. God makes every human being from the same stamp or die. And yet, not one of them is similar to the other. And it's very important in reading this to keep the first part of the statement and the last part of the statement together, right? That is, that the uniqueness of every human being is a testimony about Gdulato Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right? It's not, God forbid, right? God tries to coin 1,000 coins, but damn it, he can't get them to look exactly alike, right? It's actually a statement, human uniqueness redounds to the glory of God. That's the basic claim of this Mishnah. Equality should never efface uniqueness. Right? So it's not the human... Here, let me say this in one other way. It's not the human being in general. Right? It's not the human being in general who God... and God values, and we are asked to value. It's actually the human being in particular. It's all the difference in the world in certain ways, right? I mean, presumably you've all, different times, right, worked with people who love humanity but hate people. No, I mean, seriously. Some of them are like professional activists, right? I mean, they like love everybody. This is, I hate most people who ever walk into their Dalai Lama. So, right, this argument is that uniqueness is a statement of God's glory. So, you know, one of the things that Yitz Greenberg likes to do, which is sort of interesting, is when he's trying to sort of convince American Jews that they have to think more deeply about Torah, he says, you know, what are the things that America promises us? What are the three things? And everyone says, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And he says, okay, what are the three dignities that every human being has according to the foundation of Jewish theology? And, you know, everyone sits there totally quietly. And, you know, he basically has people, you know, say over and over again, right, infinite value, equality, and uniqueness. That's what it means to be human according to Jewish theology. And I think that's the work that this Mishnah is trying to develop for us. Now, the Mishnah ends on a, I think, surprising note that will raise, to some extent, Ross's question from a while ago. The Mishnah ends by saying, "Lefichach kol echad ve'echad chayav lomar bishvili nivra olam." Therefore, everyone, I actually probably render this, every single one, right? Every last one of us is required to say, for my sake was the world created. So now I want to know, what do you make of that ending to what we just did? Yeah?
Can you say infinite value of God in your place? Can you translate them into Hebrew?
Into rabbinic Hebrew? I don't know if I can. I could try to make it up in modern Hebrew. Those are modern philosophical terms. I'm not sure Chazal had abstract categories like that. You know, that's that they're not... It would be interesting to know whether you could actually... I think that it... I don't mean this is a criticism. The better question, in a way, is could you appeal to language from the medieval philosophical tradition to say these things? I have to think about that. I can't say I've ever really thought about it. But I don't think you can have rabbinic categories for kind of philosophers who are much more concrete in certain ways than that.
So we're extrapolating those.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can read those sources philosophically, but that's not the same thing as saying that they had those words.
It's, I mean, it's the three statements. It's the one human's worth an entire world.
Right, exactly.
The same father.
Right, exactly. I mean, you know, you could say something like, you know, in medieval language, you know, you'll tell me, Adi, if I'm like, but you say like, you know, Erech Bilti Mugbal, right, as one. Can you say that? Is that... I'm like, yeah, I don't know why you would, but you could. We could play with that, but actually, let's not do that now. But yeah, I actually think that implicit in your question is a very interesting discussion about what it means and how it should best be done, right, to read four philosophical categories for a literature that's not particularly interested in philosophical categories. It's interested in concrete truth claims. It's interested in what Itamar just said, right? It's actually, if you said to the rabbis, how would you say this? They would say, I just said it. You just read it. What do you mean, how would I say it? I just said it. But you're like, and us in our sort of more abstracted, you know, sort of, what, you know, medievals talk about, you know, like ideas that are mufshatim, right, that are abstracted. That's an importation, at least of language. And then you could ask the question, does that also change the nature of the thought? And that's a really interesting question for another month of working through that question. Okay, so anybody want to say anything about the ending of this Mishnah? Is it surprising? Is it weird? Is it... What do you make of the way it ends?
I think it's like surprising, but at the same time beautiful. And like I was thinking about this when Alex asked her question, like if you add infinite plus infinite, right, you still have infinite. And so if you say five lives versus one life, but each life is infinite, right? Five times infinite is equal to the one times infinite. And so if you think the world was created for me and I have the obligation to realize that every single person is reading that the world was created for them, it's almost like we have this connection that we have to look out for each other.
Okay, so can I... I don't think you were here. We here already at the for the college learning seminar. So, if people remember for a second, when we talked about that really interesting statement that Hillel says, "Imani kan hakol kan," what Hillel says, if I am here, everyone is here, or everything is here, or better, the all is here. If I am here, God is here. And the way we read that as not an arrogant statement is that that statement, crucial to understanding that statement, is that Hillel thinks that every human being, A, should make that statement, and B, in the logic by which I enable myself to say that statement also applies to every other human being. Meaning, just to say that more concretely, I can only say, for my sake was the world created, by a logic that requires me to understand that that's true about every other human being on the face of the earth as well. Right? It's not a statement about me alone. It's a statement about me uniquely among every other human being also uniquely. That's not an English sentence, but you know what it's trying to...
It's reading where it's saying kol echad ve'echad. It's not...
Exactly.
It's like, you have to say this, but like, everyone has
exactly.
You have to recognize that everyone says
exactly. No, that's actually why I stopped to emphasize. I actually should have, you know, rendered when I played with the translation here. I should have changed everyone to every single, or maybe even if you want to be every last one, right, is obligated to say. Now I want to say one other thing, and then Hannah, I'll take your comment or question. I think there's something very deep here that I personally have. It's something I think about a lot. And I am still groping for a way to really sort of bring this home, both for myself and for other people. I think that implicit in this Mishnah are two really interesting claims, right? One is that self-worth of a certain kind is a mitzvah. And two, and this is the part that I think is more radical, self-worth, authentic self-worth, is never comparative. Authentic self-worth is never comparative. Meaning, right? Like, some of us are tempted some of the time, right? I mean, you've, you know, maybe this makes some of us nervous to say. Like, you know, you're walking down the street and you're thinking, I'm like horrible. Like, I'm worthless. I'm unattractive. I'm stupid. Right? I'm just describing my walk from the train to the pumpkin. So I'm worthless. I'm stupid. I'm unattractive. And then you like see someone else and you're like, well, sure as hell smarter than she is, right? And I'm better looking than that guy, right? And I got into schools that that person in a million years couldn't dream of getting into. And I think, like, in a way, the mission is sort of cutting that off at the best thing. That's not self-esteem. That's just, like, obnoxiousness, right? And self-esteem somehow, the kind of self-esteem they're talking about, I want to say, the kind of self-esteem they're interested in is the sort of esteem that comes from knowing that God made me. And as we'll see in the next Mishnah, or in a little while from now, God loves me. Sort of, period. And I don't know, it'll be interesting to think about, even in your own lives, you know, over the course of the next few days, you know, moments when you feel bad about yourself and the ways that you're tempted to make yourself feel better by looking at other people who are worse. It's a very kind of basic human temptation. By the way, hang out with a bunch of like ninth graders, right, and listen to them talk to each other, and you'll, about the person who's not in the room with them, and you'll see the sort of struggle that's so endemic to human beings to sort of derive my own self-worth from, you know, scratching other people down. Hannah, please. Anybody else? Alana, you want to say something? No? Okay. So, yeah, okay.
I just think that it's really interesting that this comes in the context of preparing witnesses, that it's in language of Bishvil Li Nivra Ha'olam, that it's not like Bishvil Kol Adam Nivra Ha'olam or something. That I think it's interesting in like the first person that.
Yeah, go ahead.
Also, the person who's testifying needs to be thinking of that.
Yeah, so that's a good segue for the last, actually, thing I want to put out there about this Mishnah. I might have said this to this group in some other context, but it sort of hit me last year, something that I think is, like, really part of this Mishnah, and it's very easy in our context to miss it, which is, I think that for almost all of us, when we see a sentence, Bishvili Nivra Ha'olam, for my sake was the world created, we aren't tempted to read that exclusively as something that was done for me. It's a category of privilege. And I actually wonder, and say I'm now like, I would say 70% convinced, that the opposite is the case. That when Chazal say, Bishvili Nivra Ha'olam, it's actually a category of obligation. Meaning, the world was created for me. Derivative of that, or even implicit already in that, is, and there are concrete expectations of me. And that, I think, would make sense of why Bishvili Nivra Ha'olam might appear also in this Mishnah. Right? Because you might end up causing someone to die. Do you understand who you are? In other words, I actually think it's if I'm right about this, it's a really kind of, the Mishnah is a really interesting critique of the ways in which we intuitively think, oh, the world was created for me. I deserve everything. As opposed to the world was created for me. What's expected of me? Yeah, go on.
You can read it as well as Bishvili, like a trail or a...
Bishvili what?
Bishvili.
Okay, how would you want to read it that way? To elaborate?
Bishvili, Bishvili.
So, right, no, I understand the pshat of what you're saying, but how would you want to elaborate? In other words, what do you derive from that? You know, what's the idea that I'm supposed to walk away with? My way, what every way, no matter what my way is, it's a way of. Okay, everyone has, you know, a unique path in this world. I would suggest that that's. Again, another, you know, in the spirit of Jordan, a nice midrash on the pshat here. I don't think that that's, because I'm not aware, this is a statement, I do not have remotely the kind of memory or the learning to make, but I'm going to just sort of, I would want to know whether there's any rabbinic source that talks about the notion of a human being having his or her own shvil, sort of bezeh lashon, in order to accept that as a pshat reading. Aval lo chashuv, lo chayav liot pshat. Means an interesting midrash.
Yes, it's a pshat. You have it, for example, bizugiyut, in relationships. Shekol echad yesh adam.
Yeah, no, for sure. I actually just meant it linguistically. Meaning, does the word shvil ever apply in a personal way like that? And
lo
nireh li.
No, yeah, the idea I'm suggesting midrash.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, yes, yeah, no, that's what I'm saying. So as a midrash, it's... Yeah. And I actually think it's a nice midrash in a particular way, which I hope we'll get to next time, which is that it seems to me that one of the implicit ideas of Tzelem Elohim is what Rabbi Soloveitchik will come to call shlichut. Not just shvil as in my unique way of living, but shvil as in my unique path of contributing. This Mishnah is actually about service in some fundamental way. Okay, before we move on from this Mishnah, any other... Yeah, Jan.
So, you said that you're only 70% sure of the reading about obligation. Can you say more about that?
Well, because I think...
Because I like it, so it'd be cool if you could be
on. Well, okay, so here's what I would say about it. The reason I only say 70% is because I also think that the reading of my knowing my own value is clearly there.
Yeah.
And... I could imagine a reading of the Mishnah that basically wants to end by saying, you should know your own values at Tzelem Elohim. The reason why I don't find that persuasive, why I'm 70% there, and now as I'm talking, maybe I'm 75% there, right, is because this Mishnah is so stubbornly about an ethos of not just you,
Yeah. That
it would be a weird way to end. If all we had was the first one, sort of, right, if all we had was, pardon my ridiculous rabbinic formulation of this, the bava kama of this Mishnah, right? The first gate, the one that said, right? If all we had was, you know, ki'ilu ki'em olam male, right? Therefore, but even there, it's formulated about others. So, do you understand what I'm trying to do? I'm trying to make space for the possibility that maybe the Mishnah is actually talking about self-image. The problem is that, as Ellie pointed out, right, the language of this Mishnah pushes us to understand that you can't purchase theologically your own self-image without thereby acquiring the self-image of everyone around you simultaneously.
Right.
Which is why I would find the language of Bishvili as only about me just odd and strangely discordant with everything else in this Mishnah.
But that reading of if it's about me, then it's about what I owe to the world and what my obligations are. That incorporates others inherently.
Yes.
And like, posits your own infinite value. Because
I agree with you.
If the creation of the world is so that you can contribute to it, then you must be pretty valuable. Because otherwise, how could you stand in relationship to the world and have anything to give it, or...
Right.
Have anything it actually can ask you. Like, for the world to ask something of you, you must be like...
All right. I'm now at 80%.
Okay.
Okay. Rachel, and then I really want to push forward. Yeah.
Sorry.
No, it's fine.
So this idea of, like, having obligations and things expected of us, that seems to me to presume that we're coming from we are privileged and we have money and we have talents and we have things that we can actually give. We make the same argument for people who are living in the third world that they also have that obligation
Yeah.
to them,
and how does it translate? So I want to sort of answer this very sort of quickly and inadequately, but I think there is something... I don't mean this as a critique of your question. I just want to explain something. Your question, I think, is very culturally located. I mean, all questions are culturally located, but this in particular, and in the following way. Because I think when we, many of us, sort of relatively privileged in the history of the world, think about obligation, we think about one of two things or both: careers and philanthropic dollars. Right? But I think in Chazal, You know, obligation can mean, right? Are you willing to comfort someone who's mourning? Are you willing to, probably one of the most important sugyot in the Yerushalmi about, you know, human obligation. Are you taking care of your ill parent? Are you, in other words, I think it needs to be stripped away from its sort of upper middle class, upper west side context. That said, right, I don't think people who have immense privilege should allow themselves to excuse themselves from the question of, well, if you do have an option of any career possible, and you do have an option of philanthropic dollars, right, how should you use those privileges as obligations? But I don't think that Chazal for a second would entertain the notion that, oh, only people who live in immense privilege, you know, and you think about the number of people in the history of the human race who have lived with the privilege of many of the people of the Upper West Side, let's say, just randomly chosen, or America, right? That those people are excluded from obligation and service, I think is totally unimaginable to them.
On a much more basic level than we usually talk about in these texts.
I think that's right, and the statement in Chazal for that is, Echad am arbe v'echad am amit, uvilvad chichaven libo l'shamayim. Right? Whether you end up, you know, doing a huge amount, or whether you end up doing tiny amounts, like, the point is the dedication to doing God's work. So, I mean, the question is real, but I want to make sure we're kind of aware of, you know, it's not just grand gestures, right? It may be very small moments. Someone might be the case, I think Jewish theology would say, that I was brought into the world so that in one particular moment, when there was someone who was in need of care and no one else gave it to her, that I was there. Right? I think it was my hedge fund, I think it was my this, I think it was my that. You know, it's not that. It's actually some moment that someone living in the poorest slum of wherever would be equally capable of. And maybe even some of the ways that we're privileged undercut some of those ways of sheer presence in certain ways. So there's a lot there to sort of think about and play with. Okay. Shifting gears for a minute. I want to spend a minute, and originally I was going to have you do chavruta for this, but it's actually much later than I hoped, so I think we're going to do it together. The next thing we're going to see is, again, another of the most famous sources of Tzelem Elohim, and also of Chazal more broadly. And I want to spend, what I want to do is simply read it, and then ask people, I'm going to ask a question before we read it, okay? What are these two people arguing about? Okay? But what is the nature of their argument? What is the nature of their conversation? Okay? This is a source that appears in two places. Midrash Sifra, which is the Tanaitic Midrash on Sefer Vayikra, and then it also reappears in the Yerushalmi Nedarim. Something like Perek Dalet Halacha Dalet. Did I say Perek Dalet? Perek Tet Halacha Dalet. 9. So starts Vaftala Reacha Kamocha, Rabbi Akiva Omer, Zeklal Gadol Vatora. Ben Azai Omer, Ze Sefer Toldot Adam, Ze Klal Gadol Mize. Right? Love your neighbor as yourself. Rabbi Akiva says, this is the great principle of the Torah. Ben Azai says, this is the book of the generations of Adam. This is an even greater principle. We'll say just before opening the floor that the word Klal Gadol requires a lot of thought here. Klal Gadol generally appears in a halachic context. I'm not aware of a lot of agadic places where this is used. And what it exactly means is Tzarich Iyun Gadol. There's still people sort of writing about this in the world of rabbinic scholarship. I'm going to sort of, for our purposes for now, really bracket that conversation and just ask what's going on in this little exchange. Okay, I want to take like 5 or 6 thoughts or comments about it, and then we'll try to kind of see if we can make some headway or sum up from what people say. What's the conversation? Ben? attention, please.
Well, I guess that Rabbi Akiva seems more focused on acts versus an outside on the sort of core principle from which you derive those acts. Or you could frame it as halakha versus agatha, even, I guess, that treat someone else as yourself. Pretty halakhic in a way. Whereas the idea that we're all derived from one, whether that's Adam or God, is a gutter. Or like psychodynamic versus psychotherapeutic. It's all that sort of...
Wait, explain that last one, in this context?
Psychodynamic would be like, focus on the actions. Uh-huh. You know, think about what acts you do and where that goes wrong. And psychotherapeutic would be, think about the originary myth from which, you're deriving your actions.
Okay, good. All right, thank you. Let's take just a bunch more. Itamar, please.
I think you also could potentially read both of them as talking about the motivational sides of how you treat other people, and then they're saying different things about that. And one of them relates first to thinking about yourself. Love other people as you love yourself. So, first, it's really coming from inside and from how you relate to yourself, and then apply to the other. And the second one is no, forget about that. Even separate from your internal psychological state and feelings, relationship to yourself, we're all from the same place.
Good. Okay. Other people?
I think the specificity of the Hafalaya Hakamoka gives you many more outs than the Dolda Dam, the Sefer Dolda Dam, in that you have to define what is love, who is your neighbor, how does it mean that you react to yourself like them. There are many more ways that you can kind of minimize it into nothingness rather than just putting out a claw, and saying that this is what it is, and work with it in that way.
So this is just a kind of question about people's comments so far. It would be interesting to go back to the three of you who just commented and ask to what extent you think that these are actual disagreements or kind of different prioritization, different strategies for moving people. I mean, there's a lot to say there. Let's not take that up explicitly yet, but sort of keep that in mind. Other people? Yeah, Rachel?
I don't see them as a conflict at all.
Okay.
I see them both as really required work, but like for Ben Azai saying that everyone was created in the image of God. That's the end of the verse that he's citing.
Right.
So, in order to treat someone like yourself, you have to have that they were also created in the image of God. So I feel like that Rabbi Akiva's point has been Abba's point as a basis.
Okay. Okay. Great. Thank you. Maybe one last one, Alan?
I think the good thing when they're paired together is that, the drawbacks of the loopholes of what Rabbi Akiva said, like Ellie pointed out, are pretty efficiently closed just by reading that Azai right afterwards.
Great. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So people just said a lot of interesting things, and maybe I'm going to try to, if I can hold them all in my mind now, sum some of them up, and then you'll remind me if I missed some in this formulation. First of all, starting from what Benji said, and in a way, connecting to what Rachel said, because they're actually, in different ways, you articulated different versions of a very related thought. So, it's almost like asking, where does Judaism begin? Does it begin with actual obligations, or does it begin with an ontology or a metaphysics that gives rise to those obligations? Right? I mean, if I wanted to be, if this is totally obscure, then fine, you can throw away this thought, it's not that interesting, and I don't want to spend time elaborating on it. It's almost like, if you read it this way, Rabbi Akiva is the sort of Levinasian ethics comes first, ethics before ontology, ethics before anything else, like the concrete obligation, right, to another. And Ben Azai comes along and says, that obligation derives from somewhere. And if you just give me an obligation that's not rooted in something, why am I going to do it? Right? And its foundation would actually seem to be in Tzelem Elohim. Now, why, by the way, interesting here, if that's right, something that I think many of us take for granted, but philosophically is not fleshed out, is why am I assuming that the consequence of Tzelem Elohim is love? that in itself is worth, at some point, thinking about together. But so that's one possibility, right? So sort of where do we begin? Do we begin with obligations, or do we begin with, as it were, agadah? Agadah in the most powerful, positive sense of that word. That, by the way, the way we answer that question might have some really important consequences also for how we think about, in general, the relationship between concrete norms and the theology that, in theory, undergirds them. Right? There's a lot to say about that. Okay. Second possibility, right? Eli said something that I think is really important, right? Which is the verse, Ve'ahavta l'reicha kamocha, which I hope to give a series about at some point, you know, in the next few years, right? Has two major problems. Number one, what do you mean by love? And number two, as Jesus is asked in the Gospel of Luke, tell me, Master, who is my neighbor? Right? And the history of Judaism is filled with attempts to grapple with exactly this question. Who is my neighbor? Right? And very often, my neighbor has been taken to mean other Jews. Although in the modern period, there are all kinds of people who come along and say, that's just a bad reading of Vayikra. So it's almost like, you know, the second reading is, we started with, is it ethics or is it metaphysics? What comes first? The second reading is, well, wait a second. Are we talking about loving our community? Or are we talking about the image of God in every last human being on the face of the earth? What is the core teaching of Torah? Yeah, someone had their hand up. They wanted to sort of ask something or comment.
You mentioned sort of a piece of what I was wondering about. It's sort of maybe just what Rachel said of, you know, if you don't really love yourself, and or your relationship with yourself is not what this
Great.
Intends you to act out to other people, then what Ben Hazai says is very, very important to have right alongside this. So you have to learn what Kamocha means. First get, or not even first, but be in this state. And even if you're not, this sort of construct of how you would love yourself is how you need to project with other people, which might not be so clear.
Great. So I think your comment actually is a sort of another version of what Itamar, I think, was groping for, right? And maybe that's the third version, right? The word kamocha is like a piece of dynamite.
That's what sort of sticks out.
In red, right? Love your neighbor as yourself. You know, we're going to read, you know, lest we think this is just a kind of, you know, American, you know, preoccupation, we're going to read, you know, a classic source that basically says, okay, but what if I hate myself? Love your neighbor as yourself. Now, of course, then we have to deal with, here's sort of footnote, right? What does kamocha modify in the verse of ve'ahavta l'reicha kamocha? Does it mean ve'ahavta kemo she'ata ohev et atzmecha l'reicha? Or does it mean ve'ahavta l'reicha shehu kamocha? Right? Love your neighbor who is like yourself. That goes back to our discussion last week of Rav Dessler versus Levinas. Right? In other words, am I supposed to love the other because in some sense we are the same? Or is it sort of the distributive property, right? You put ve'ahavta l'reicha in parentheses and kamocha stands outside it. So ve'ahavta kamocha l'reicha shehu kamocha. You should love as yourself your neighbor who is as yourself. Right? All of that is open to discussion. But if we take Itamar's comment and yours seriously, right, we have the sort of concern of Ben Azai, potentially, that, you know what, Rabbi Akiva? That pasuk not only has Eli's loopholes, it has your loopholes too. Right? What if I just don't like myself, so I don't have to like other people either? So, in other words, there's an absoluteness to Ben Azai's pasuk, to use language I think you used, or, you know, to use something like that. Right? It's not, you can't wiggle your way out of Ben Azai's formulation. Neither for excessive particularism, nor for, but I don't like myself, reasons. Yeah, go ahead.
I was actually thinking about it a little bit more practically.
Okay.
Sort of, I always thought of as sort of the way you live your life, help others live your life, live their lives, sort of the way you do, and which includes also sort of the way you treat yourself, the way you care for yourself, you would care for others. But I mean, I can think of a lot of people who I wouldn't want them to treat me the way they treat themselves. And sort of practically speaking, the way mm-hmm. they care for themselves, I wouldn't want them to
right.
treat me like that.
Right.
Even more than just like self-loathing. Like
right. Okay. Yeah. Fair enough. Maybe that's yeah. Those are versions of the same thing, but yours is stronger. Now, let's just look at two traditional commentaries on this debate, which I think will say versions of what you guys have said. So first, Korban HaEidah, an Acharon on the Yerushalmi, says, Zeh Sefer Toldot Adam, Shekol Bnei Adam Ba'im Me'av Echad, Hu Klal Gadol Me'i Ve'avta L'Re'acha Kamocha, De'lo Ka'i Ela Al Re'acha. Want to, right, to be clear? This is the book of the generations of Adam, is a greater principle than love your neighbor as yourself, because the former includes every last human being, and the latter includes only your neighbors, or however you understand what your neighbor is. Right? It's a very clear formulation, and by the way, a deeply universalist formulation too. It's very clear here. Kol b'nei Adam v'imei av echad, and of course, for that he has both Genesis 1 and the Mishnah and Sanhedrin that we read. Now, you know, we may get to this in the last of the six sessions that we're going to have in this, but maybe not. I actually think that Vayikra itself is already concerned with the danger that when you read the verse, V'ahavta l'recha kamocha, you're going to say, oh, okay, that's great. That's everyone who I know. Or that's everyone who I like. Or that's everyone in my tax bracket. Or that's everyone who owns a condo in my building. Right? And that's why, just a few psukim later, in Vayikra Yotet, Yotet Lamed Gimel and Lamed Dalet, the Torah will say about the ger, Ve'avtalo kamocha. You should love the stranger as yourself. And we'll render the stranger here as the person who is not in your tax bracket. Meaning the person, the ger in biblical Hebrew means a person who owns no property and is therefore vulnerable. So I think the Torah itself is already dealing with the temptation to say, okay, that's great. Love the people you already love. Right? And it's sort of a dramatic pushing of the envelope. Again, we're not dealing here yet at all, right, with the question of what is the love that the Torah is commanding. That's a different discussion. But whatever it's commanding us to expand the circle of who kind of is to be the recipient of our love. Now, the Ravad on the Sifra says, this is sort of Itamar's comment, and really a version of either Rebecca's comment or my misunderstanding of it or my tweaking of it. He says, Zeklal gadol mizeh, this is an even greater principle, de'i mikra kama, because if you were talking only about love your neighbor as yourself, that is Rabbi Akiva's verse, hava amina, adam shehu bazui yachol omar, gam ani avazeh et chaveri. Right? A person who is degraded. And I really have to think, I have to say, I have to spend a lot more time thinking about the way the word bazui is used in Chazal. Does it actually mean primarily an attitude that I have towards myself or an objective description of my situation? I'm actually not sure. And I think it would yield interesting texture to really work that out. But a person who is degraded could say, okay, I love you like I love myself, which is to say minimally to none at all. Or, I will love you in such a way that you'll be like me. How will you be? Beaten up, oppressed, degraded. Right? Okay, just give me one second to finish this text. Now I have no idea why that gap appeared there. She'eni makpid gami mevazimoti. Because you know what? Alright, so they humiliate me. That's why I think bazui here, I think its primary meaning is like having not just mochel al kvodo, which is to sort of say not be sort of demanding about your own honor, but actually like to be completely frivolous about it. To just allow people to treat you as a doormat. Aval, but the Ravad continues, Me'apasuk ze sefer toldot adam, shenizkarbo bidmut Elohim asa oto klal gadol mizeh. Right? This, by the way, is, if you read it closely, is not a Hebrew sentence. There's like a couple too many sort of prepositions and conjunctions, but ki et mi ata mevazeh dimiut diokano shel makom. Right? No. Wait a second. You think that because you allow yourself to be degraded, you could allow others to be degraded? Just remember who it is that you're degrading. Right? Dimiut diokano shel makom. By the way, diokan, I think, I can't say enough times, I am not a linguist. I think that diokan is an Aramaic derivative of the same word we saw for Tzelem Elohim, which is icon. Diokan is like a kind of reverable version of an icon. I think that diokan is considered, if you look at, anyone have a Jastrow? Look what Jastrow says about diokan. I think diokan is like held up as an icon that is set aside to be worshipped. Although I don't totally understand that because I think that's what an icon is too. Being, so I'm not sure. I may have even gotten that from Jastrow. I have to ask someone who actually is a scholar of both Aramaic and Greek. What did he say?
There's a referential transformation.
Okay, so that is probably where I got it. Okay, the idea there is the same. I am sometimes tempted to translate these sources as face. You are actually degrading the face of God, but that may be an overreading. Because after all, that's part of what an icon is. Not literally the face of God, but something that's a little more powerful than image, a little more concrete. Okay, there were someone who had their hand up, I think. Oh, Ross, yeah, please.
I was curious, can you say a little bit about the Ramadans?
The what is?
The author of the text.
The Ravid. What's behind that question?
Just trying to contextualize.
He's in Poskier, in the 14th century, I believe. The Ravid's claim to fame is that, I mean, this is, he would not have been happy with this description of his claim to fame. His claim to fame is he wrote the most famous ongoing critique of the Rambam's Piskei Halakha in the Mishneh Torah, and among many other things, defended some more traditional theological beliefs from the Rambam's attempt to purify them. If you want to learn more about the Ravid, you can look at a book by my late teacher Isidore Tursky called Ra'abad of Poskier. What did you say?
Where is Poskier?
Somewhere in France. Anybody want to help me here? I'm geographically, I can barely find my way home at night. Yeah. I think that's right. Okay. So, I would like to make one other observation about this text, which is to ask the question, why does Ben Azai, of all the psukim, quote Genesis 5:1, Zeh Sefer Toldot Adam, instead of quoting Genesis 1:26-27, which would make more sense in a way? Why not say, Tzelem Elohim bara oto. Nase Adam b'tzalmenu kidmutenu. Wouldn't that be more sense? Wouldn't that make more sense? Why quote Genesis 5? Which, you might want to take a minute and just look at what Genesis 5 is if it's not totally fresh to you. What is it? Yeah. No, your thought.
I think like a little bit more obvious in connection with what we just looked at is that it goes into Toldot and like it reminds us that we all go back to this point. And also that like in 1:26 that I is like still in future tense of God like anticipating creating God, and it's also about like dominion, whereas chapter 5 is not about dominion. It's just about being in God's image.
Okay, great. Interesting. Yeah, Tamar and then Hal.
I think it's also, we're talking about the Klal Gadol Batorah, and I think the phrasing of this Sefer Toldot sounds like it's saying, like, the Torah is the book of the generations of Adam. So it's like a description of the Torah itself. It's the story of humanity. Therefore, it is also the central principle of the Torah.
Interesting. Interesting. Okay. Yeah. Alan?
That was exactly what I was saying.
Rachel?
I mean, it leads into a genealogy of everyone. So I guess it was, like, we're all included within that, like, very, very obvious, in, like, a very obvious way. Then I think that there's something to say.
Great. So just for a second, if we take Hannah's comment and Rachel's comment, right, together, right, first of all, 126 would be about the future. 127 is actually already about something God did. So I was tempted to go in your direction, but now I actually want to rethink that for a second. But I think the second part, Hannah, of I think what you said, if I remember correctly, and then Rachel, what you just said, maybe is what's actually important here, which is, right, Ben-Azai is, let me say it this way. If I said to you, who are the people in Genesis 5 and what did they accomplish? You might say, I don't know. All they did was a little beghetti. Right? I don't know who most of them are. And maybe Ben-Azai is interested in them precisely for that reason. Meaning, okay, Adam HaRishon was Tzelem Elohim. Avraham Avinu was Tzelem Elohim. You know, the Rambam was Tzelem Elohim. Heschel was Tzelem Elohim. But, you know, Yosef Shlumpovich from, you know, some town somewhere, whatever, right? And it might be, I'm suggesting it might be that Genesis 5 does that work for him. Just saying, no. The Sefer Toldot HaAdam, meaning all, Toldot HaAdam, meaning all of them. Like, all of them. Everybody. And so that work, that pasuk does, in a sense, more work. And that is actually connected to Itamar's sense that, let's put it this way, the concern of the Torah. The only hesitation I have with that is, I suspect that Chazal did not think Sefer Toldot Adam referred to the Torah as a whole. You could very easily render Sefer Toldot Adam as, this is a record of Adam's genealogy to refer to Genesis 5. But midrashically, we might say, right, exactly. So, I just wonder whether the sheer fact that we're cataloging lots of people who are not known for anything does exactly the work that Ben-Azai wants here, which is to kind of, again, bring home that the universality of it, right? That we're talking about every human being ever. Now, maybe as a sort of footnote, I'll just mention something in light of what Itamar said. I don't find this very persuasive as a reading of Chazal, but one Israeli, American Ole, Israeli scholar, has recently suggested that because he thinks that in Vayikra, Vayahavta l'Recha Kamocha, you can't get into the depth of this argument, actually does not refer to other Israelites, but refers to all humans. The problem I have with that, by the way, is I don't see any evidence that Chazal thought that's what Vayikra was about. But he wants to say, because I can make the case that in Vayikra, Ve'atal Recha Kamocha applies to everyone, so what is Sefer Toldot Adam doing? So he suggests, you know, everyone makes the mistake of saying, oh, it's an allusion to the Seifa of the Pasuk, right? B'dmut Elohim Asalto. But this scholar, Moshe Benevitz, wants to suggest that Sefer Toldot Adam means that Ben-Azai is suggesting that the Torah is intended not just for Israel, but for all of humanity. So that the real debate is, Rabbi Akiva talks about there's an obligation to love everyone, and Ben-Azai says there's an obligation to bring Torah to everyone. I I think there's still a lot of work for him to show. In other words, what's interesting if you read an article like this is he spends a tremendous amount of time showing what Vayikra meant. But in a certain way, that might be a non sequitur. Because again, unless you can show that Chazal also thought that, I'm not sure you've done the work. And the notion that Zeh Sefer Toldot Adam is an allusion to the idea that God thinks that this... There's a lot of stretching there. For now, I think the readings that you guys offered are more convincing. That, by the way, is a strand of Chazal that scholars have been uncovering in the last generation, that is those strands of Chazal that actually think that ultimately all human beings are intended to embrace Torah, and that that's a form of universalism, which I hasten to emphasize is not, right, in any way a form of pluralism. It's a form of universalism that says, right, everyone should be a Jew. And another American Israeli scholar named Menachem Hirschman has a book called Torah L'chol Ba'ei Olam, which is an attempt to argue exactly this point. Let me just push forward for just a couple more minutes, and we'll look at the third text. Here, we'll start with this text now, and then we'll really kind of look at it more closely next time. I think, let's see. Now, this is, I guess, one of the most famous Mishnayot in Pirkei Avot, and yet there's a lot of questions that it raises. Who haya omer? Who here is Rabbi Akiva? Rabbi Akiva used to say, Chaviv Adam Shenivra B'Tselem. Remember that I said, we don't have any argument here yet for why Tselem culminates in love. I think, by the way, that many members of Chazal thought that was sort of self-evident, and it would be interesting to think about why and what the, if they were pressed, how would they conceptualize that? But he says, beloved is the human being, for he or she was created in the image of God. And then this very interesting comment that I'm always grateful that I don't have to vocalize, I don't have to punctuate rabbinic Hebrew, because it's not totally clear to me exactly what punctuation mark you would put here. Chiba yitera nodat lo shenivra b'tzelem. Right? Even more beloved, abundantly loved is the human being, not merely was he / she created in the image of God, but we were told it. It's really, really interesting. We'll come back to this. We'll start talking about this today, and then again, we'll come back to it. But so far, the logic of the Shemitah is very interesting, right? We are loved. I assume, by the way, Chaviv means, right, beloved by God, and potentially implicitly is, and therefore ideally should come to be beloved by you. I'm not married to that reading, but Chaviv Adam Shenivra B'Tselem, beloved is the human being, for he was created in the image of God, and then even more so, because it's not just a fact, but it's fact that we are made known. Nodat lo, it literally is, it is made known to us. And then part two, we're going to spend much less time on parts two and three of this Mishnah, even though there is a lot to talk about, and particulars and universalism questions here become very important, but I just want you to see the parallel structure. Chavivin Yisrael, beloved are Israel. Shnikru'u banim lamakom. Right? Beloved are the children of Israel because they are called God's children. Chiba yitera nodat lahem shnikru'u banim lamakom. Shne'emar banim atem la'shem Eloichem. Right? It's not just that Israel are God's children, but that Israel are told that they are God's children. And then finally, Chavivin Yisrael, shnitan lahem kli chemda. Right? Beloved are Israel because they are given a... how would you translate kli chemda? How does this person translate it? Desirable instrument. That is like a really kind of tone deaf. Yeah, that's much better. Right, exactly. A precious vessel. Good. Thank you, Itamar. I hope you're busy translating the entire Mishnah. Sax. Great. That guy can turn a phrase. Chiba yetera nodat lahem shenitan lahem kli chemda shaboni ra'olam shenemar ki lekach tov natati lahem. So Israel is also deeply loved because it was given the precious vessel that is Torah, and it is all the more so loved because they were told that they were given the Torah. So I want to just sort of ask the question here. By the way, in case you thought that Ben Azai and Rabbi Akiva were disagreeing in some way, right here you see Rabbi Akiva explicitly connect love and Selim. Right? Remember, you get what I just said? Meaning in the previous, in the Sifra we just read, we had Rabbi Akiva say, V'afel Rifa Kamocha, comes Ben Azai along and says, you know, Selim Elohim, in case you thought there's some sort of machloka, here we have Rabbi Akiva himself saying, no, love is derived from Selim. That's interesting. Maybe that's actually Benavitz's argument. That because we know Rabbi Akiva connects love to Tselem, maybe that's a defense for saying V'haftala Re'acha Kamocha applies to all humans. The problem is you still have to do the work of what Re'a means. People understand what I just said? Or was that just sort of my own shorthand? Yeah. Is my own shorthand? Yeah. In other words, here we have Rabbi Akiva explicitly tying belovedness to every human being, which maybe, I don't remember if Benavitz says this, but which maybe buttresses his claim that for Rabbi Akiva, V'haftal Arecha Kamocha could refer to all humans. I still don't like that because I want to know any case in Chazal where Re'a is not taken to mean a member of your covenant community. But it's interesting. Now do you understand what I just said? Some of you? Okay. Well, once we have a statement attributed to Rabbi Akiva that talks about all human beings being loved by dint of being tselem, it no longer seems tortured, maybe, to say that love your neighbor as yourself refers to all humans. The reason I don't like that, as I said, is I still want to know Re'a. Some of you, if you're interested in this, might want to look at Ernst Akiva Simon, who was one of Rosenzweig's prime students, and the father of Uriel Simon, one of the leading Bible scholars of Israel this generation, and the founder of Oz V'Shalom, the religious left peace movement. Ernst Akiva Simon wrote this famous essay called The Neighbor Whom We Are to Love, which is an argument for why Re'a refers to all humans and not to Jews. It's the most famous modern attempt to say love your neighbor as yourself is a universal mandate. There are others, but that's perhaps the most famous. Ernst Simon. Simon, written Simon. Okay? Now, what's the relationship between being given something and being told that we're given something? I'm still back to my Johnny Walker head here. Right? But what's the relationship? I mean, what is the logic of Rabbi Akiva here, where he says, no, yeah, it's love. Love for human beings that they're created in the image of God. Love for Israel that they are called, that they are God's children. But even more love is the telling. So, yeah, please.
It sort of seems like, if it was just true, we could not know that it was, and that the fact that it's sort of explicit that God told us so that we could actually act accordingly as opposed to wandering around all the time.
Okay, so great. Very nice. Yeah, please, Atlanta.
But in telling us, do you make it was true?
Say more.
Is the knowledge itself something? If the knowledge itself is an act of love, is it more love? I'm not sure I buy this, but if the knowledge itself is an act of love, is it more love?
Well, okay.
But
I think he's saying that everyone about whom fact A is true is also notified about fact A. Meaning, the Torah tells every human being that he or she is infinitely valuable. Okay, you know what? That's an importation of a rabbinic interpretation of Tselem Elohim. The Torah tells all of us that we are created in the image of God. And that means that the set of people who are told is equal to the set of people about whom it's true. At least in the imagination of this Mishnah about the pervasiveness of Torah in some way. Yeah, Alex.
The first thing that this made me think of is like a sort of like a cliche that, like, you know, in a relationship people will say that, like, you know, I want you to say you love me. Like, you know, and they'll say, well, you know that I love you. And they say, right. I want you to say that I love you. Like, there's a certain reassurance in it. Like, I can give or I can do, the actions are in of themselves may be an expression of love, but by saying it, you give a certain, like, comfort, reassurance that can only come in words and direct, like, explanation.
Okay, great. Ellie? And then Shana and Rachel, you were hearing them? Did you? Yeah, okay.
I want to push back on your Rabbi Akiva generalizing reading here, back to the other source. It seems like there's a progression here, and it's, yes, it says, you know, Chaviv and Chabadi Tera, and it's not, this one is built on top of the next, on top of the next. But what would it mean to say, everyone has this love, and if you know it, then it's even kind of more love, or however you want to translate. Why do you need the next two steps? If that Chaviv is the same for right. Jews, and then Jews who got Torah, as everyone in the first place, it seems good. Like
you're right.
He was reading a progression. Yeah.
I think you're definitely right, and that's a really good point. And that, okay, I'm back to rejecting Benovitz's argument. Meaning, no, I think that's fair. Meaning, Rabbi Akiva says, yeah, every human being is loved, but clearly Israel is in some way more loved. I mean, look, you know, this is a conversation we could have at some length, and this is something I hope to come back to in my own research if I ever have time to do it again. Is the question of, are there any rabbinic sources that actually refer to non-Jews as banim lamakom? I'm not sure what the answer to that is. My inclination is there are not, which I find troubling. But I think, in other words, that every human being is loved by being human, but Jews are God's children. That seems to be the logic of Rabbi Akiva here. And then we could, as sort of Jews inheriting the tradition in the 21st century, think about what we want to do with that. But, so fair enough. Meaning, that makes sense that there's still a kind of right set of obligations within that are primary. Shana, and then, you know, Richie?
I think, like, having made known this love is much more, like, demanding of the set of the object. So mm-hmm. If you say that you love someone, you're sort of, like, necessitating a response in a different way than you would if it just, like, existed. If it just existed, then you can just, like, sort of dote on and, like, think about how much you love these other people. But if you tell them that, then there's something that they sort of, I don't know, might, like, need to give back.
So can I take your comment and Alex's together and suggest maybe that if I love someone, that's great. That's nice. But if I actually tell someone that I love them, I've actually established relationship. The fact that a human being is created in the image of God might suggest that God feels related, but there's not been a space established between God and us. And the moment of telling, right, is the moment when there's some kind of mutuality that's established. And you're taking it away, Alex's reading almost in an opposite direction, or taking it further, which is, it's not just about making us feel better, but it's actually about making us feel the weight of what is true, right? I mean, I don't know. I'm trying to think about this for a second. I mean, this is sort of a crude question, and I don't like the implication, but I'll just sort of say it. Like, would you feel more reluctant to hurt someone who you thought loved you as opposed to someone who has told you they love you? Because hasn't the other person taken, the person who's told you, taken a risk in some way that the other person who just feels it hasn't? Something's changed. And I think that's what you're, Rachie, kind of moving towards, and that might be part of what's going on here. It's a love that is, let's say, relational love as opposed to just an emotion. Benji, you were waiting.
I also think giving someone knowledge grants them a certain amount of independence. You know, with Dr. Steinitz, we did that verb in Shema, basically, and how with knowing comes the need to bring some sort of moral agency to what. And it feels to me like this list is basically the list of bringing someone up. You create them, you name them, and then at some point you make them conscious of what that means and what they have to in turn do. And they have to become creator as well as created. And I think there's a nice textual detail where it returns to creation in the last line about Torah, you know, and you you were given this desirous vessel in which the world was created. So it returns us to the first motive, right. And in giving Torah, we have, and receiving Torah, we have some responsibility to recreate the world according to the Torah that was given to us.
Great. There's a contemporary Christian philosopher who's very involved in the world of science and religion discourse named Philip Hefner, who interprets Tzelem Elohim to mean that we are, in his language, created co-creators, which is sort of what you're groping for, right? That the meaning of Tzelem Elohim in a contemporary theology is being a created co-creator. We are, on the one hand, created, derivative, you know, not the author of our own being, and yet we're created and asked to be. And in a way, you know, created co-creators, for those of you who have read or read with me Soloveitchik's Isha Halakha, right, you could imagine he would really like the notion of the human being as created co-creator, right? It's not a bad description of book two of Isha Halakha. Itamar and Jana, and then I'm going to sort of, let me tie this up.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing I thought about in the first part of that, that like humans were made, not only made with Tzelem, but also it was made known to humanity as such, like made me think, and I don't think it's pshat, but it made me think that all creation is really made in the image of God, that humans have a special characteristic of consciousness and a special awareness of our creation in the image. And I think that would also then, like, following that into the next ones, it would imply also that not only Bnei Yisrael are Banim Makom, but perhaps only Bnei Yisrael, like, understand themselves really as such.
Yeah, I think that that's a midrash, which I have some sympathy with, but especially for the second part. But yeah, I mean, I like what you're trying to do. I don't think that is, my God, I'm having a language breakdown. I was going to say mishtalevable. It is not fully integratable with the larger rabbinic picture of what a human is versus what the rest of the creation is, but fair enough. Fair enough. Yeah, Jana, and then...
So I think you were getting at this to Rachie and Alex's point. I think it's one thing to, maybe it's even selfish, not in a negative selfish way, but just in a selfish, sort of amoral selfish way, to have awareness of your love for someone. But to actually say it is what creates that relation, and it's a shared experience then. And to say, I love you, or to say, do you know that I love you? Or now this is actually something that's relevant to you, as opposed to just something that's relevant to me. And loving someone is as much about you as it is about them, because it says something about who you are. But and so I think there's sort of a nice thing that it maybe does have that progression. Because if you don't know where you fit into that, then what you say to others is empty. But I also think it has implications for what you were saying earlier about self-esteem. So if someone's really suffering about themselves, then it might be a priori true that they're infinitely valuable.
Right.
Is completely irrelevant if it's not known to them. And so, it's that jump between it being a truth about the world and something that's experientially verified, and verified is like a weird word for that, but like in that way. And it also reminds me of, I was looking at Ketubot a lot yesterday, and the Masechet, not actual ones, and I was thinking about how what is sort of the less legal, more metaphysical, inspirational meaning of what it means to have witnesses to Ketubot. And I think it's this. I think it's one thing to know that we're committing to each other in a certain way. It's another thing that other people, and in fact witnesses legally and you know, theologically, have to know about this. This has to be true in the world, and we have to take it public to make it true. And if it's not spoken or some other or put into words in some other way, which I think gets to Itamar's point about what's fundamentally human, language I think is really fundamentally human. So if it's not created through speech, then it's sort of just like living in this place where it doesn't really bear much responsibility.
Great. Okay. Yeah, I mean, it has occurred to me many times over the years that one might suggest that one of the many ways one could formulate what it means to have a spiritual life. But I want to, before I say this, I want to emphasize again that we not hear this in this American idiom, which is, it's all about the cultivation of self-love, right? Right. But it strikes me that maybe the Mishnah says, no dot, lo, it was made known to him, but it doesn't say, yodeyahu, for a reason, right? That we were told that we're created in the image of God, but do we know it? And that in a certain way you can say that spiritual life is about going from having been told to actually knowing. Or having had it made known to knowing. Which, as we all know, right, are two different things. I mean, have you ever turned to someone who you know loves you and said, do you love me?
Yeah.
Right? I'm not suggesting anyone in this room has ever had a moment of insecurity like that, but right? I mean, there's a way in which I think very interesting here, what it would mean to, and maybe that's part of what it means to say, that that's relative. Again, if we're going to take love and selim, like Rabbi Akiva does, as interwoven, maybe that's part of what it means to say, Bishvili Nivra Olam. Okay. First thing I want to ask you is that next week, bring back this packet because we are not near done with it. I'm going to ask you almost as a piece of, well, if you have time at some point this week, just look at, you can skip Avot 3.1, which I want to talk about a little bit next time, but take a look at the Rambam and Rabbi and Bar Nura on the bottom of page 4 and how they understand the Chibaya Terah. Just be interesting for you, and it's how it relates to things people have said here. And then next time, we'll come back to this packet, especially the back page, which you don't have to look at all. Two things, just by way of closing, you know, I want to just encourage us to... this is true for me about basically any shiur in this style that I ever give, but I want to sort of emphasize it about this one in some ways, you know, all the more so. This is not a shiur that's about interesting ideas to think about. Right? It's not what it's about. It's not its purpose. I mean, I hope there are interesting ideas to think about. But it's also about sort of opening ourselves to the possibility of what it would mean to sort of dwell inside of these ideas. What it would mean to actually, you know, really ask myself how my life on the street, on the subway, in this building, in a dining room, with my partner, with my lack of a partner, with my whatever, right? How my life would be different, how my sense of what it means to be worthwhile intrinsically would change, how my understanding of what it means to imagine every other human being as worthwhile. What it would actually mean to really kind of sit with the reality that those people who we're sometimes tempted to think exist in the world just to perform menial tasks so we can live our comfortable lives are as beloved of God as we are. What it actually means to really kind of imagine this as the foundation of actually what it means to live a religious life, which I would argue is the meaning of Zeklal Gadol Batorah, right? That is what undergirds it all. Okay, so, and I am always happy to have conversations with people about that, you know, from a philosophical place, and more interestingly to me, from a kind of experiential ethical place. And finally, just a reminder about what I said at the beginning, which is you should feel free to approach me with suggestions for how we might spend an hour tomorrow evening. Yishar koch.